Let's briefly look at the two truths according to the four schools. So for that, actually, you have a chart towards the end of your handout. So remember in the two first philosophical schools, the Vaibhashika Sautrantika, they accept that there is an external independent world there. So if we look at how Vaibhashika talks about conventional truth and ultimate truth, in the ultimate truth, well, conventional truth, it first says a phenomena such that an awareness apprehending it is not cancelled if it is broken up or mentally separated into its, it is cancelled if it is broken up, mentally separated into individual parts. Which, what that effectively means is, if something can be broken down into something else, it's not really ultimate truth. It's not sort of like the building blocks of the universe. So for Vaibhashika then, all the things that are made up into cups and stuff, cups, all those things are not conventional, not ultimate truth, because they can be destroyed, they can be broken down into something more basic. Whereas ultimate truth is, it's a phenomenon such that an awareness apprehending is not cancelled if it is broken up, mentally separating into individual parts. So, and the example here we see is directionally partless particles. So for Vaibhashika, ultimate truth is what is the ultimate basis of our reality, which is at a physical level, these directionally partless particles, and at the mental level, it's partless moments of awareness. So for Vaibhashika, this is really what is ultimate truth. What is the foundation of this independent world that we experience? Whereas Sautrantika also accept that there is an independent world, but when they talk about the two truths, they're talking more about the different types of awareness that we have. And so for them, anything that is an object of a direct perceiver, something that observes directly, anything that is an object of that is ultimate truth. Meaning that we directly, through our senses, we can perceive cups. So cup is ultimate truth. Whereas what happens is we understand the cup through what's called here a generic image, a mental image. So we relate to this physical world through these mental images that are created in our mind. Those mental images, of course, are not the actual thing. It's an image of that. So that is what is conventional truth. And the way they define it is, conventional truth is a phenomena that is not able to perform a function, ultimately. So that mental image, of course, can't do anything. Whereas the object itself, the cup, can perform a function, ultimately. It does things. So that's how they define conventional and ultimate truth. But again, a similar idea, similar basis as Vaibhashika, but a little bit different way of positing them. Whereas if we see all the two higher schools, Chittamatra Madhyamika, if we look at the examples, we see that the conventional truth are things that exist, like pots and cups and so forth. And if we go over to the ultimate truth column, we see that ultimate truth is emptiness, meaning that these conventional truths, the ultimate truth is how they exist, that they do not exist in the way they appear. They're empty, in the Chittamatra case, of being an external object, and in the Madhyamika case, they're empty of true existence or inherent existence. So this is how the two truths are defined in the four schools. And if you want to read a lot more about that, then that at the top there, that first source, Appearance and Reality by Guy Newland, that is quite an easy book to read. It's quite thin, where a lot of this information came from anyway. So if you want to look at that in more detail, then that is a good book to read. So I just wanted to briefly mention that. So of course we are now going to look at the two truths within the Prasangika school. Of course we've already had a little bit of a look at the ultimate truth, emptiness, and now we're going to be looking at conventional truth, means all the things that exist and what is their conventional nature. And that is that everything is a dependent arising. So that's what we're going to look at now. And this brings us to the fifth of the reasonings, the reasoning of dependent arising. And that is, so we see from these two statements that form is empty, meaning form or body or all phenomena, in fact, do not exist independently, do not inherently exist. But that, of course, doesn't imply they don't exist at all, because emptiness is form, is saying because things are empty of independent existence, then form and body and other and phenomena can appear and function because they're dependent, not independent. So the reasoning here is is that things are empty. Of course, we can substitute and put form here if we want, but in general, things are empty of inherent existence because they are dependent arisings. So remember again, this is emptiness. Yeah, that's the topic now. Because things are empty of inherent existence. Another way of saying that, of course, is that things are not independently existent. Why? Because they are dependently existent. And that term in Buddhism is dependent arising. The word arising means coming into existence. Means things are coming into existence dependently. So, if we can appreciate what do we mean by things being dependent, then of course that is going to be very helpful in understanding emptiness. So let's have a look now at what does it mean for things to be dependent arisings. That the conventional nature of things is that they are dependent phenomena. And we can look at this in three ways. The first is that things are dependent because things' existence depends on causes and conditions. You know, for example, this clock here is a dependent arising, and it comes into existence dependently because it comes into existence through causes and conditions. That one of the first conditions we need for this clock to exist is someone had to think about designing it, Then, of course, we needed all the raw materials needed to be collected. They needed to be refined. All the various components needed to be manufactured, and all those components needed to be assembled. And then all the people and factories and all the other parts, all the other things that were involved, also these conditions. So without all these causes and conditions, there would be no clock. Normally when we see these two words together, this word here is what's called substantial cause, and this is often called cooperative conditions. And as a simple example to understand the difference is a plant. The substantial cause of the plant is the seed. So the substantial cause is the stuff that transforms into the result. Whereas the cooperative conditions are all the other factors and conditions necessary for that transformation to take place. So in the case of the seed to the plant, cooperative conditions would include the soil, sunlight, water, fertilizer, all these things. But the actual substantial cause is the thing that transforms into the result. So in the case of a plant, it's the seed. In the case of a clock here, it would be all the material. So I think that is fairly straightforward. So the second way that things exist dependently is they depend on their parts. Again, this clock, for this clock to exist, it depends on its parts. Without the frame, the plastic base, the battery, the switches, the screen, the electronic components, without all of these parts, there is no clock. Again, that, I think that is fairly straightforward. But remember here, is what we're saying is that because things are dependent, it means that they're empty of inherent existence, independent existence. So these ideas here should be overturning that things exist independently. That's the reasoning. But I think for many of us, we're quite happy to accept that this clock exist depending on causes and conditions and parts, yet at the same time accept that when we walk in the door there's already a clock sitting on the table. No? True or not? But that shouldn't be possible. Because this should be overturning the fact that there is a clock sitting on the table when we walk in the door. But it doesn't seem to have that effect. Why? Is because we don't understand these two ideas at the deepest level. To understand them at the deepest level, we have to go to the third point. And I've listed a number of different terms here, that things also are dependent arising in terms of depending on imputation, labeling, designation, conception. So all of those four terms mean the same thing. So if you sort of understand one, you understand all of them. I just put them there because in different texts, they use the different way of describing this. Some texts talk about imputation, some use the word labeling, some designation, some simply conception. Now, when we look at that, we think, Okay, I think I know what that means. That means that there is a thing here which we're calling a clock. Again, this is sort of a little bit of a simple understanding of this. To understand that at a deeper level, what we can appreciate is that when we look out on the world, then we're just receiving a mass of sense data, particularly through the visual sense, of course. That's one of our dominant senses. So when we receive all this data coming in, then we have to make some sense or meaning out of all of this stuff. Otherwise, we couldn't function in the world. So what we do, or try to do at least, is we group various collections of data together and make them into a single object. So we draw lines, we're sort of line drawing, we draw lines around various collections of data and make them into an object so that we can make some sense or meaning out of all of this data. But we need to do more than that because we don't exist on our own in this world, and to be able to communicate with others, we need to give names to those things that we've created so we can communicate to others. And how we divide up all this stuff is not fixed. It's completely arbitrary depending on the context and the meaning that we want to get out of what we see. For example, if we all look over here in this direction, you may draw simply one line around all of that data and say there's one cupboard there. Or you may draw five lines and say there's five cabinets there. Or you may draw seven lines and say there's seven offerings there. Or you may draw many lines and say there's many objects there. So how many things are here? Depends. It depends on the meaning that we want to get out of what we see. So we determine what is there. We bring things into existence through this line drawing and giving the name. That's what it means by imputation, labeling, designation, conception. So most often, of course, not always, we would, when we're looking in this direction, we would draw one line around all of this data and say, here's a clock. Or, again, we would, in this direction, we'd just normally, most often, we would draw one line and say, there's a cup. But of course, we could probably equally well draw two lines and say, there's a cup and a lid. That's also probably quite common how we would do that. If we needed to distinguish this bit from this bit, we would, instead of drawing one line, we'd say there's two things there. Not one. There's two things there because there's a cup and a lid. Or equally well, we could say there's one thing there, there's a cup. That's okay. Both are okay. I mean, depends how we want to relate to that and what meaning we want from that. Now, what that means, of course, is that in the basis, there is no cup to be found in the basis. We bring the cup into existence through drawing a line around a certain collection of data and giving the name, which means that things are labeled, or the term we often see in the text is things are merely labeled. Merely means just, only, meaning things don't have a level of existence more than being just labeled, meaning they do not have some existence from their own side. There is no cup to be found there amongst the bases. So merely labeled also means that the object is not findable amongst the bases. And so sometimes, in a poetic way of saying this, sometimes you also see in the text something like, Things are mere name. But of course, a cup is not a name, but it means, that means just that, that it's merely labeled. That's its level of existence. Or sometimes you see things like, things are mere appearances. Mere appearances. So again, generally when we see this word mere, it's implying this, that there's nothing more than that. It doesn't have a more solid level of existence than just existing within our conceptual framework. Now, let's have a look at these two ideas based on this now, and see if we can understand these two ideas in a slightly deeper way. Sure.
That means by drawing these lines, we are actually getting into induced duality.
No. That's coming, but I'll give you a brief answer and then I'll explain more. There is no problem with drawing lines, because we have to do it. If we can't, we can't function. For example, a newborn baby doesn't know how to draw any lines. It takes some, I think, months before they can draw some very crude lines. And then as the young child is growing up, of course, they're learning to draw better and better lines. And we are the same. We're continually trying to improve our line drawing ability. You know, often when we come to a new situation we've never seen before, we go, sort of scratch our head and go, well, what's that? We don't even know if it's a single thing or a collection of things or what. We don't know how to make it. And so we're sort of struggling to draw some good lines to make some meaning. And of course a baby is, you know, it's very basic what they can do, and they just have to keep improving, and we're always trying to improve our line drawing capacity. So there's no problem with that. The problem comes because we draw the lines and give names, but then because things appear to exist independent of us, we contract around the line drawing and we turn these lines into boundaries. It's because we don't realize we're doing this line drawing. Because of our ignorance and stains and see, we grasp onto those appearances. That's the problem.
Permanent.
What we do is we grasp onto that. We grasp because of our ignorance. That's right. Of course, intellectually, if we stop and think about it like we do now, we can sort of understand that's what we're doing. But again, how we behave is, here's a cup on the table when I walk in the door. There's already a cup there. You know, to us, experientially, because of these stains in particular, the world, as soon as we see it, it appears to exist as many separate, discrete things. We don't realize that because of our upbringing and training, that in that microsecond we've drawn all these lines and given these names because of our past history. We don't realize that that's what we've done. We just look and we go, oh, look, there's already 10 separate things there. When I came here, there's already those 10 things there. That's how we experience it. So that's right, because we don't think about these things, and so we just accept.
How is it that we draw the same lines? Maybe this is what you want to say. That we all draw the same lines
that's very cultural, isn't it? Even as a human, like, when it's snowing, we just sort of say snow, but I think Eskimos have 20 different line drawing abilities. Because for them, it's crucial to be able to have these 20 different ways of drawing lines for their livelihood. We don't need that, so we just draw one little line, say, there's some snow. Whereas they have 20 different terms and labels for different variations in those, data. Because that's important to them, that's helpful for them in their life. So it's very cultural, actually, how we draw the lines. But again, because we have to communicate, we have to somehow have very similar ways of drawing lines, otherwise we couldn't communicate. And sometimes you find that from someone from a completely different culture, you can't communicate because the way their background and your background are so different, and you're trying to talk about the same thing, and it's like just about impossible.
It's like the Indians didn't saw the American ship, and they came to the States for the first time, they just didn't saw it, although there was a gigantic ship there.
Yeah, and that's it. And that's actually, I think there's a lot of scientific evidence in terms of perception that we filter out the vast majority of the data because it's not important to us. Yeah, we only pick up the bits that are important to us, and then we do use that. So let's look at this year. So this is supposed to be like a timeline. This is a seed, and this is the plant that it produces. So we say that the plant is existing depending on causes and conditions. So again, the substantial cause for the plant is the seed. The conditions necessary are the soil, sunlight, water, and so forth. So the plant exists depending on these causes and conditions. Now, we believe and accept that things exist independently, independent of our conception. If that's the case, then at what point does the seed become the plant in this process? Where does the seed stop and the plant start? Because remember, and it should be fixed and obvious, because we believe that things exist independent of our conception of them. So where does the seed stop and the plant start here? Who can tell me? So for you, this is the plant. Well, it's out of the soil, see? So this is a plant, not a seed.
It doesn't.
It's a continuum.
But remember, experientially, we don't see it like that. Experientially, there's a seed, produces a plant, and so there must be a fixed point where the seed stops and the plant starts. Because we accept or believe these things exist independently of our conception. That's what we believe, experientially. So, of course, when we look at this, intellectually, we can understand exactly this point, that actually there's this continual process of change happening, and the point at where the seed becomes the plant is the point at where this configuration of data stops looking like our concept of seed and starts looking like our concept of plant. And of course, our concepts of seed and plant vary, so for some of us, it would be here, some of us may be here, some here, maybe up here. So we bring the plant into existence because of our concepts, our understanding. Now there's another point here that can be helpful. We say that the seed and plant are in a cause-effect relationship. It's in a causal relationship. Now the question is, does the seed stop existing before the plant comes into existence? So again, the question is, does the seed stop existing before the plant comes into existence? So there's only two answers, yes or no. So which is it? Remember, we believe in independent seed, independent plant. So if that is the case, there must be an answer to this question. So, yes or no? If you say no, what you're saying is that the seed exists at the time of the plant, which by definition is impossible. If two things are in a cause-effect relationship, the cause cannot exist at the time of the effect. So no is illogical. No cannot be the answer. If you say yes, then you say the seed ceases to exist before the plant comes into existence. So the seed has ceased to exist. Where is the plant coming from? No. The seed has stopped existing. Where is the plant coming from? So what we can understand is that our simple notion of cause and effect, if we believe in independent existence, now becomes completely illogical. It just can't work. It just can't work. It's illogical. So these sorts of arguments are a lot of the arguments that Nagarjuna uses in his classic text, that fundamental wisdom of the middle way, which was the basis of the Majjhimika system. He says things like, oh, you believe in independent existence? What about this? What's the answer? And then he uses all these examples of action and agent and fire and fuel and walking and walking and all of these common sense ideas which we accept. When we look at them based on independent existence, they become completely illogical. They just can't work. So he uses these arguments to pull the rug under our feet about grasping onto independent existence. Of course, if we accept that things are merely imputed, as was said here, there is no moments of change, but there's a continuous flow, unbroken continuous flow, and within that we just simply change the label. But as soon as we divide that up into discrete moments of change, we're in trouble. We're stuck. So does a seed exist here?
In a different shape.
No, does a seed exist here?
In a different shape. Okay. Because it wasn't like, you know, if it didn't have any DNA, it couldn't be there, you know.
Right, but that we, so that's right. So there is this continuous flow of change, and to make sense of that continuous flow of change, we develop concepts like seed and plant to understand what's going on. The process, correct. But again, we don't realize that we have developed this conceptual framework to explain this. We believe that there's a seed there producing a plant there, independent of our conceptual framework. That's the problem. That's what we're grasping onto. And that's how we behave. We're not behaving as if we have developed this conceptual framework to be able to understand this process. That's not how we behave in daily life. Because in daily life, we walk in the door, there's a clock already there. We're not walking in the door going, okay, I've just drawn a line there because it's useful because now I can tell the time. We don't do that. Do we? We just say, there's the clock already when I walk in the door.
Usually, yeah.
Yes. And of course, because we do that and we have a pleasant feeling, then there must be some attractive quality there causing my pleasant feeling. I want that clock. Give it to me. It's yours, but I want it. I'm going to take it from you. Okay. One more point here is we say that the plant exists depending on causes and conditions. Or another way is that we can say that the result depends on the cause. But this view is also saying that the cause depends on the result. So how does the cause depend on the result? How does the cause depend on the result? How does the seed depend on the plant?
Logically dig down to the seed. When we see the plant, we know that there must be a seed.
No, I'm talking about here. At this time, this seed that's here now, let's say this is the present moment, how does that seed depend? depend on the plant. No, not in that way. It is, but that's not what I'm looking for. Right, you're getting close. You can't call something a seed unless you have the idea of plant. I mean, whether or not it produces it is irrelevant. You can't call something a cause unless you got the idea that it could produce a result. Cause of what? So it doesn't have to exist at the time, but to call it a seed means, implies, that it could produce a plant. So that's how it depends on the plant. Because otherwise you can't call it a seed. You can't call it a cause. So that's how cause depends on result. These are sort of mutually dependent. And we can see that very easily, like the example I gave the other day. You know, is this big? Big only exists relative to small, like cause and result. Of course, big and small exist at the same time. They don't have to exist at the same time, but they have to depend on each other. Okay. Next point is the parts. And this is something I did the other day, but I'll do again, is this pen, of course, exists depending on its parts. But is there a pen to be found here amongst the bases? Can we find a pen here somewhere, independent of our conceptual framework? And so again, we went the other day, you know, is this a pen? No. Is this a pen? No. Is this thing here a pen? No. Is this tube a pen? No. Ink, blah, blah, blah. So where's the pen? There's no pen to be found there. And then again, usually people can sort of say, okay, that's easy. The pen is the collection of that stuff. And so again, we've got the collection here. So is this a pen? And then they say, oh, no, no, it has to be in a certain shape. And so then we, you know, do this process we did yesterday. You know, when does the pen actually come into existence? You know, at what point is there a pen here? And so again, when we do this, we can understand that the pen only comes into existence when this configuration of data here closely enough resembles our concept of pen. And our concepts have at least two parts to it, appearance and functionality. So when this appears closely enough as what we, our concept of pen is, and this seems to perform the function of what this idea pen, then there's a pen. So there's no pen to be found amongst the bases. Because again, as I said the other day, if there is a pen there from its own side, independent of our conceptual framework, it would mean that a caveman came in the door here and they'd see a pen and they'd start writing with it. I think maybe a caveman would see some sort of weapon, perhaps, and try to stab some animal with it. And, of course, if a little tiny ant came here, they may see a home, somewhere to live. So, again, you know, is this a pen, a weapon, or maybe a chewing stick for a dog, or a home for an ant? Depends. It depends on us. So pen exists within our conceptual framework. The pen is something merely labeled on that basis. There is no pen to be found here amongst the basis itself. That's why we say think the pen is merely labeled. It's not findable amongst the bases. So here then, we say also, like the plant situation, the plant example, the pen, it depends on the parts. Or more simply, we can say the whole depends on the parts. But this view is also saying the part depends on the whole. For the same reason. This can only be called part of a pen if we have the idea pen. We don't have to have the pen existing, but you can only call this a part of a pen if you have the idea pen. So the part depends on the whole as well. Now, here, we're saying that the pen exists depending on causes and conditions, parts. So the pen is something merely labeled depending on the parts. Whereas we normally say this is a pen. Meaning we normally experientially believe that the pen is this collection of parts here. This is a pen. And so this is actually another example of our old friend cognitive fusion. So the old cognitive fusion's also popping in here, making a mess for us. Because what's going on is there's two things here, isn't there? There's a basis and then a label. Label pen. We are applying the label to the basis. But what we are doing experientially is we are fusing the basis and the label together. And we're saying this is a pen. We're fusing the label to the basis. And that creates a lot of problems. One problem, of course, is this basis is always changing, isn't it? But our label pen is not changing. It's static. So when we apply or we fuse the label to the basis, this somehow becomes something quite static. And that's why, one of the reasons why, when we see something pleasant, we attachment grasps onto it. Because we're sort of seeing it as something solid and stable and static. And an attachment wants to hold onto it as long as possible. And of course, by fusing the label to the basis, then that implies we are then grasping onto this as being the pen. Whereas more correctly, we should be thinking the pen is something I'm labeling to this basis because it's meaningful and useful for me to do so. It makes sense and it helps me to function, to label this collection of stuff here a pen and then use it in our daily life. So here then, what we're saying, another way of saying that is that we can say is that the whole is not the sum of the parts. The whole is something labeled on the sum of the parts. So here can be something to help us to see whether we're understanding emptiness a little bit. If we can understand that these two statements are not saying the same thing. And the two statements are, this is a pen. The second statement is, pen is something labeled to this. So, or in other words, we can say, the pen is the collection of this part, these parts. Versus the pen is merely labeled depending on the collection of parts. So again, the two statements are, the pen is the collection of parts versus the pen is merely labeled depending on the collection of parts. If we can understand those two statements are not saying the same thing, then we're beginning to understand something about emptiness. And we can now then apply this to the person. Let's try to apply the same line of reasoning now to the person. So, pen is not the collection of the paths. Pen is merely labeled depending on the collection of the paths. Person is not the collection of the paths, i.e., person is not the body and the mind together. Person is something merely labeled depending on the body and the mind. So this is the person that exists, the dependent person. Sometimes, again, we say that, you know, things are merely labeled, the pen is merely labeled, the person is merely labeled. And so sometimes then, to get across the idea of the dependent person, the person that exists, you'll see the terminology, the mere I. Again, the mere I means the I, the person, that is merely labeled on the basis of the body and the mind. Now, of course, in any given situation, we label person on some aspect of the body and the mind, and the basis can change from situation to situation. For example, let's say over in the distance someone's walking there, we can see them, but they're sort of behind something, so we can only see their head. But on the basis of merely seeing their head, we say, oh, there is Tom. So we're labeling Tom, or person, on the basis of just the head, because we see that, or some other part of the body. Or, for ourselves, of course, as well, we can label me if on the basis of some aspect of our mind as well. So the basis is always some aspect of the body and the mind, and then we label me on that basis. But that me is labeled on the basis, it's not the basis. Meaning we are not the body, we are not the mind, we are not the collection of the body and the mind. We are something labeled on that basis. So me, person, is like pen, is something merely labeled on the basis of the body and the mind. So this is the person that exists. This is the dependent me. But of course, like pen, is we fuse the label to the basis, and we believe that the person is the body and the mind, or is some part of the basis that we've labeled to. So this is so what we are doing, of course, we are contracting around this me. We are grasping onto the fact that there is a me here to be found. And this is called self-grasping. So the question is,
when you were saying that that you say, oh, this is the person, yeah, you were looking like this, we choose what we see at the moment, and then we say, okay, this is that. Looking at that, you know, the whole picture.
Yeah, I mean that. Yes, of course. If we have the bigger perspective and understand these things, then we can understand that
this is not an angry person. This is like,
well, yeah. I mean. I mean, of course we can use that language, but again, when we use that language, it makes it easier for us to slip into the grasping mode. Like, when we say, like, when we use language like this is a pen, that language is supporting the belief that there is a pen to be found here. I mean, of course this is the sort of language we use, and we have to use language that people can understand. So if we say, oh, please pass me something that I'm labeling as pen, blah, 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 people are going to look at us all strange. You know?
Yeah.
So what I'm just suggesting is that, unfortunately, the way our language is developed is, well, is to not really appreciate that we're labeling, because we're saying, this is a pen. Yeah. So again, that language also sort of makes it more difficult for us to see reality, because it's promoting the false way of seeing things.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And of course, if we use this sort of language, then we also have a very fixed perspective of things. You know, like we might say, for us, we say, oh, this is a beautiful pen. And then someone else says, no, no, that's an ugly pen. And then, of course, we argue because it's a beautiful pen. Can't you see it? Can't you see that it's a beautiful pen? Look, it's there. And so we argue. And so then, because of that language, we can't appreciate that it's actually just our perspective.
Yeah.
And they may have a different perspective. Whereas when we use the language like, this is a beautiful pen, it seems like that the beauty is there. It doesn't seem like it's just our perspective. It seems like it's actually there.
Yeah.
That's why we argue with people.
Stuck you.
Yeah, of course. You're stuck as well, of course.
Yeah,
you're stuck.
Let's just say this example, coming back of, I don't know, South America or India in that business. And you have these new ideas and new things and you come and then they say, like, what's going on with you? Are you crazy? And then, you know, so, okay, maybe I should stay the same because they're expecting me to stay the same. You know, and then you don't even evolve because of that.
But I think the important thing here, of course, is to understand this is what's sort of going on.
Yeah.
So even if we use the language, this is a pen, to keep in mind that, you know, that's really something I'm labeling to this, then it's okay, of course.
Missing
something.
The dysfunctionality of that
phenomenon. Right.
Well,
that's part of our concept. Our concepts that we develop to help is that our concept of things included in there at least is appearance and functionality.
So it's in the label.
Well, no, it's in our concept, you know, like, because we need to try to understand what's going on around us. And so we see all this stuff happening. And then we start to see certain patterns of things, and then we sort of see these patterns, and then we go, oh, there's this thing going on here, so I can see this sort of thing happening. I'll call this a pen, because that then is a useful concept to help me to explain that process, or the seed and the plant. You know, we see all this change, and it's really, like you said before, you know, is there, you know, even at the physical world level, is there things moving through time in the physical world? Experientially, it seems like there's a cup here moving through time, that this cup is more or less the same cup that was yesterday, it'll be here tomorrow, this cup. Is that really what's going on at the physical world? No. But we can go to science. Science has proven that at the physical world level, all that's happening is there's a continuous flow of change, isn't there? At the atomic level. There's just a flow of change. So fast. And that's all that's going on here, isn't it? This flow of change. But of course we have to function in this flow of change. So in this flow of change, we have to make objects and understand what that object is and what, how it works within, i.e. the functionality, the function of that, so that we can predict what's going on and work with that. Otherwise we couldn't do anything. And so we do this. We make this conceptual framework to explain and understand and predict this flow of change, and that's useful. We have to do that. But the problem is, of course, is that we don't realize that's what we're doing. We feel as if there's already all these things there moving through time. But there's nothing moving through time. There's just an unbroken flow of change. And within that unbroken flow of change, we make these objects to understand this flow. But the problem is we go further than that and we grasp onto them as static things that are moving through time. And that's where the problem is.
Just curious, does Tibetan language actually support, or the way it is designed, support how the Buddhist philosophy of the world?
Tibetan language, yeah. When Buddhism came to Tibet, there was no written language, so they devised it particularly for Buddhism. Mm-hmm. The spoken, as you know, if you've tried to learn a bit of Tibetan, the colloquial Tibetan is quite different than scriptural Tibetan. Because colloquial Tibetan has really changed dramatically or a lot over the centuries, whereas the scriptural is sort of not changed so much. So you find like a lot of the grammar and stuff is complete, quite different. So yes, the Tibetan language is very good in terms of translating Sanskrit texts.
I was wondering, like, representing the Buddhist philosophy of the world or the Buddhist style of the world, like you're saying, in English language, we have this concept of I and the objects and not the label of the objects.
Oh, you mean how is the language, how people use the language?
I
don't know about that. I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not that well conversed in Tibetan language to answer that question. It'd be interesting. Okay. No, it's the opposite. You function better. So in this meditation doesn't mean that we wipe out our line drawing capacity. Our line drawing capacity won't change. What will change is that we won't turn our line drawing into boundary making and thereby make a big mess of the world. So it's not like somehow this is going to wipe out our conceptual framework. Nothing's going to change in conceptual framework. What's going to wipe out is then grasping onto these things as being real and substantial and independent. That's what we're getting rid of. Yeah. We're not getting rid of the conceptual framework, because otherwise we couldn't function. Yeah. We're getting rid of, grasping onto these concepts, these things as being real and independent, which is what we've seen is the source of all of our mental afflictions and sufferings. Which means, like an experientially, you know, if we see a pleasant object, then we will still be able to see the pleasant object and we'd enjoy it without the craving and the grasping and the attachment. That's what would change. Okay. Sure, yeah.
Do any of the tenant systems deny the existence of the basis?
The basis. So remember, we are talking about, well, each of the Buddhist systems has assertions about how the basis exists, but all Buddhist schools say even that there's cups, let alone the basis. So the question is not what exists, But the question is, how does this stuff exist? That's the question. So, of course, in the Vaibhashika Sautrantika, there is a independent basis there, external to us. Particles that are independent, yeah? And the Chittamatrans would say, yeah, there's a basis, but it's internal. And Prasangika would say, yes, there's a basis, but that basis is not independent of us. That basis is also merely labeled. So, I mean, we can go down all levels, like person, merely labeled on body and mind. Body, merely labeled on arms, leg, chest and head. Leg, merely labeled on these two bits. Knee, merely labeled on these bits. Down, 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 down. There's no bottom. What do you mean by exist?
Well, whatever, something can't come from nothing.
Right.
You can't have nothing at the bottom and something at the top.
Yeah, but we're not saying there's not nothing at the bottom. What we're saying is that there's no inherent independent basis to this. That's the thing. This, of course, for us is difficult to appreciate because we tend to demand there must be something tangible and there for it to work. And this is going to be one of the things that are coming up now after lunch. Yeah. So actually it's time for lunch, so let's break there and we'll continue on after lunch.